Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Last Thursday, an Iowa district court judge struck down that state's law limiting marriage to the union of a man and a woman. That's remarkable, but what's far more remarkable and concerning to us is the actual decision handed down by this judge. I mentioned it last week and said we'd be coming back to it. Today's that day. We're going to be looking at why this particular decision, legalizing, in effect, same-sex marriage in Iowa, a decision this judge has stayed pending an appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court. We're going to be looking at why this decision represents something in a very worrisome way that is new, an argument that is based entirely, so this judge declares, on empirical science. We're going to be looking at the limits of science. We're going to be calling this when bad law meets bad science. It ought to lead to a good conversation. To join that conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be back with our special guest, Dr. Alan Carlson of the Howard Center. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. First, a review of some of the many issues in the news. Amnesty International's in hot water with a lot of folks, including me, for a change in their policy on abortion. They claim that they are not adopting a pro-abortion, or even by their own language, they say they're not adopting a pro-choice policy on abortion, but they are coming out against all blanket bans on the procedure. They're claiming this as a matter of human rights. It has become a matter of incredible controversy. You have the Vatican and several Catholic leaders opposing this, including some bishops who have resigned as members of Amnesty International. According to the Times of London, in an editorial praising the group for this action, they say Amnesty could in no sense be described as pro-abortion, as critics would have it. It cannot even be described as pro-choice. The new policy takes no view at all on the rights and wrongs of abortion. It is doing nothing to promote it and is not even arguing that women should always be allowed to choose. All it has done is to state its opposition to blanket legal prohibitions on the procedure and to lay out circumstances in which it can be the only compassionate option in cases of rape and incest and when the mother's life or health is in danger, period. Well, you see, that's the same problem as Roe v. Wade from 1973. It's evasive language. When you come down and say that abortion should be the, quote, only compassionate option, end quote, and then you include as grounds for this a mother's life or health, a lot of people immediately assume this means when a mother's physical life is directly threatened by the pregnancy, a very rare occurrence. But as the experience with that same language in Roe v. Wade has shown us in this country since 1973, when the health of the mother is simply left undefined, it is assumed to include the physical and psychological health, and that means that virtually any woman at any time can say that this pregnancy complicates her psychological health and thus becomes a rationale for abortion. That's why this decision by Amnesty International is so disappointing. That's why so many people are outraged. And we'll be following this story as it goes along, but it is a reminder to us that when you define human rights and you take on the issue of abortion within your definition of human rights, you're going to run into big trouble, as Amnesty International is now discovering. Speaking of abortions, also this time from Great Britain, the British Parliament is moving closer to making it possible for women to get abortions without the prior approval of a doctor, and in some cases with the procedure being carried out by a nurse. Now, this is Great Britain, but you should know that many of the same proposals made there, represented by this reality, are also being made here. There are those in this country who are arguing that abortion, which is by any estimation a very serious surgical procedure, should be undertaken without the same health regulations, without the same medical requirements that would be true for any other similar surgery. You have, even in this country, the suggestion that midwives and nurses other than doctors should be able to perform the procedure. It's just a reminder again that what is driving this is not medicine, but ideology. Now, ideology and medicine seem to intersect in so many different places. Also, this time in Great Britain, you have British scientists announced tomorrow authorized to create chimeras. In this case, the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority in Great Britain is going to allow the creation of human-animal embryos. Now, folks, that is frightening stuff. The chill should go up every morally sensitive spine. You're talking about using the DNA from human beings, and you're talking about using genetic material from animals, creating combinations. I have written about this at my website at albertmuller.com. It is a matter of grave ethical concern. But what concerns me as much as the actual decision to be announced tomorrow is the fact that this government authority that in Great Britain is responsible for setting these regulations says that it is doing so because it has conducted research that shows that the majority of people in Britain are, and I quote, at ease with scientists creating the hybrid embryos. Is that the new moral test? Is the new moral test that is going to be applied by the regulative agency, the regulatory agency responsible for setting the rules, going to be what the public will accept? Then you don't need the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. All you need is the Gallup organization or a pollster. This is no way to conduct a serious ethical inquiry. All you have to do is look at the history of human civilizations, and you will see that human cultures have accepted, tolerated, and been, to use their words, at ease with any number of morally abhorrent procedures and policies. Egg freezing, of course, is a big issue, as you have so many women, especially career and professional women, who are delaying adulthood, delaying motherhood, delaying marriage, and delaying conception and bearing children. Now, it's not just the women who are doing this, of course, it's the males as well, but it just so happens that the female reproductive system does not have an indefinite length of superior operation. Let's put it this way. There is a fertility clock that is within every single woman, and once she reaches a certain age, especially over the age of 40, conception becomes less likely and pregnancy becomes far more problematic. And yet, in the name of emancipating women, you now have egg freezing being made available, and both in Great Britain and in the United States, there are calls to make this universally available. On this program just a few weeks ago, we were looking at data that indicates that it just so happens that this procedure, even though it is very expensive, is not delivering on its promises. It just so happens that freezing eggs, in many cases, does not lead to the actual pregnancy at a later time that a woman hopes for when she decides to undergo the procedure. It just so happens that there are limits, after all, and that's true for men and women, but especially for women, when it comes to conceiving and bearing children over the age of 40 is problematic whether you have frozen the eggs at a younger age or not. Interesting news coming out of New York, where the movement known as Reform Judaism, that is the more liberal wing of Judaism, and it is now the dominant wing. There are now more persons involved in Reform synagogues than any other branch of Judaism. It is preparing to adopt a new prayer book that is intended, according to Lori Goodstein of the New York Times, to offer something for everyone. Traditionalists, progressives, and everyone else, even those who do not believe in God. Now, this has my attention immediately. According to the news story, references to God as He have been removed. Not only are references to God as He removed, but whenever Jewish patriarchs are named, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, so are the matriarchs like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Ms. Goodstein writes, the prayer book took more than 20 years to develop and was tested about 300 congregations. Now listen to this. Rabbi Frischman, in this case it's Elise D. Frischman, the editor of the prayer book, says it reflects a recognition of diversity within our community. We have interfaith families. We have so many visitors at ceremonies, bar mitzvah, that I could have a service on Shabbat morning where a majority of people there aren't Jewish. Now listen to this. Rabbi Frischman also says, there are even those in my community who come to Shabbat worship each week who don't believe in God. How do we help them resonate with the language of prayer, which is very God-centric and evokes a personal God, a God that talks to you in a sense? There are many, many Jews who do not believe in God that way. Now, you know, there are various experiments with diversity, but I don't think I've ever encountered anything quite like this. The effort to write a prayer book that would include both people who believe in God and people who don't. The amazing thing is, as Rabbi Frischman says, prayer is rather God-centric. Are you amazed by that? After all, what is prayer if there is no God to whom one is praying? It's not just Reform Judaism that's about this kind of movement. You'll find it in liberal Protestantism and in many other circles as well, where this new idea of a postmodern spirituality has supplanted authentic faith in the one true and living God. Folks, when you're concerned that your prayer book or your approach to worship might be too restrictive because it speaks mostly to those who believe in God, if you see that as a problem, maybe you're the problem. We'll be back for Intelligent Christian Conversation about this decision from an Iowa District Court judge. We're going to look not only what the decision means, but at where this argument would take us. I'm Albert Moeller. Today we're talking about when bad science meets bad law, and they certainly intersected last Thursday in an Iowa District Court room when there in that court, Judge Robert Hansen handed down his decision that was striking down Iowa's law restricting marriage to the union of a man and a woman and otherwise legalizing same-sex marriage. As we said, he did put his own decision on hold, pending an appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court. However, at least one homosexual couple was married between the time that he sent down his order and when he issued the stay. The big concern here is not just the fact that it happened. It's one more precedent on the road towards the normalization and legalization of same-sex marriage, but the particular nature of this decision. A lot of it reads like it was written by Lambda Legal, one of the homosexual activist organizations that was a party to this particular suit. But there is another part to this decision that went beyond even what gay activists could have hoped for, and that is the language and the reasoning that the judge employed in his decision and in the trial. He excluded everything by his own decision that he did not define as empirical, scientific, technical knowledge. Now, that might sound strange to you when this is a courtroom dealing with the issue of marriage. It should sound strange to you. In other words, explicitly excluded from the discussion was any reference to the history of marriage, any reference to the morality and principle of marriage. Instead, it was all about what the judge decided was science. And not only that, he dignified social science as if it is science. With us as our guest today is Alan Carlson. Dr. Carlson's president of the Howard Center. He is the director of the Family in America Studies Center, editor of the Family in America. And Alan Carlson was to have been one of those who was testifying in this case, but this judge excluded his testimony. He acknowledged that Dr. Carlson holds impressive academic credentials, but he said that Dr. Carlson brings no empirical knowledge or data to this question about the effect of marriage on children. Dr. Carlson, welcome to the Albert Moeller Program.
Happy to be with you.
I have to tell you, I've respected your work for so long, I was not surprised to see your name listed here in this decision as the defendants in this case, Polk County, in Iowa, had sought to have you to testify. Why did Judge Hansen reject your testimony?
Well, you're right. His reasoning was that historians, including me, don't do much number crunching. We don't do empirical, testable work. That's basically was his argument. And as far as it goes, that's true. I've done some of that in the past in a couple of pieces I've done. But generally, I'm a narrative historian. I judge documents and interpret documents of the past and try to make sense out of them.
Well, let's get to the bottom line here. The question should be, how do we know what marriage is? And this judge is suggesting that evidently number crunching is the way we're supposed to know what marriage is and what the effects of changing marriage from a heterosexual institution and allowing homosexual marriage, what that would mean. Can we come up with an adequate answer to that by number crunching?
Well, to some degree you can. If the judge actually looked at what really is coming out of the empirical studies of marriage and family, there's an overwhelming body of evidence that marriage is good for men and good for women and good for children. That's even coming from social scientists who have biases in the other direction, but who in some cases are honest enough to report their results. But, you know, there's a deeper problem, and you're right. It's this problem of scientism, which is kind of run amok. There's an old joke that, you know, a member of parliament in the 17th century trying to make a point, support an argument, would have appealed to Holy Scripture. But by the 18th century, maybe they would have appealed to Shakespeare. And by the 19th century, it would have been to, say, Ralph Waldo Emerson or somebody. In the 20th century, all such appeals tended to be to a sociologist. And is that progress? Not in any real sense, because the best thing empirical science can do, even social science, is look at some very small, very carefully structured questions. But you miss the big picture. You miss the forest by focusing solely on the minutiae of the trees.
In this case, I think Judge Hansen intentionally missed the picture. I want to read his finding number 57. To me, this is the most notorious paragraph of his entire decision. This is how it reads. Homosexuality is a normal expression of human sexuality. Although homosexuality once was classified as a mental disorder or abnormality, empirical research since the 1950s consistently has failed to provide an empirical or scientific basis for this view, which has been renounced by professionals in multiple disciplines, end quote. Now, let me just list a couple of concerns with that. Number one, he repeats the word empirical in here. He really wants to put his entire argument on this kind of empirical evidence. But when he points back to the 1950s, so far as I can come up with, he has to be talking about Alfred Kinsey's notorious research that was based upon all kinds of fallacies and involved all kinds of abhorrent practices and wasn't based in any kind of science at all. The American Psychiatric Association listed homosexual behavior as a psychiatric disease until the 1970s, when all parties now admit it made a political decision, not a scientific decision, to reclassify homosexuality in one meeting in Hawaii. Yesterday it was a psychiatric disorder, today it's not. No one believes that psychiatry can be practiced in that way. Now, it looks to me, Dr. Carlson, like this judge was simply determined to justify what he wanted to do by this resort to what he calls science that I reject as being science at all.
Well, your point's very valid, and he was twisting every argument he could. In fact, this decision is really the worst one ever handed down by any judge on a same-sex marriage case. He even, after having rejected me as a witness because I'm a historian and would only bring an interpretation of history into play, he goes on, actually paragraphs 96 through about 101, actually buying into a theory of history propounded by Nancy Cott, a Harvard historian, who builds the whole case that marriage is constantly evolving institution. Over time, it's had no consistency. It's just been a tool that's been useful to certain societies at certain times in certain ways. But there's nothing, no basis to it, no reality to it beyond what people want. Well, that's just a bogus history. So, I mean, in a sense, he's even after throwing out the history that I would have presented, and I think most social historians would have presented, he then buys into a theory of history that supports his own argument.
Which leads to my second criticism of his decision, which is it is impossible to employ his own methodology consistently. He can't possibly answer his own question on the basis of what he identifies as empirical scientific research alone. Human beings are far too complicated to be reduced to empirical observation. I can't explain exactly why I like this brand of coffee better than another based upon empirical science. The biggest questions of life are not accessible to empirical research.
No, and you're pointing to a real problem, and actually in the modern academy right now, which shies away from the big questions. It used to be that theology was the queen of disciplines at the universities. It's been a long time since that's been true. But anyway, you're right on target in terms of what the problem is.
Our guest today is Alan Carlson, president of the Howard Center and editor of The Family in America. He's also the author of the book The Natural Family, due out in October, is his book entitled Third Ways, How Bulgarian Greens, Swedish Housewives, and Beer-Swilling Englishmen Created Family-Centered Economics, and Why They Disappeared. Now, that's a title for you. Back for Intelligent Christian Conversation on the impact of this decision when bad law meets bad science. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Here's the question I want to ask you. What kind of evidence or argument are you looking for if you're going to answer the question, how do we know what marriage is? Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. Last Thursday, I heard the news of this decision handed down in Polk County, Iowa, a decision nullifying, setting down Iowa's law defining marriage as a union of a man and a woman. And immediately the headlines spread across all the news networks. Iowa decision legalizes same-sex marriage. Judge Robert Hansen, the judge in this case there in Polk County, Iowa, put his own decision on hold, pending review by the Iowa Supreme Court. But in the meantime, at least one homosexual couple was granted a license and got married in what is evidently considered today a legal marriage in the state of Iowa. As I say, I was handed the news, and yet it was only later when I was actually handed the decision that had been posted online that I began to see what was actually taking place here. I knew something was afoot when you had gay rights activists immediately going to the press and saying that this is the most important decision that had yet been handed down, their biggest success. And one line really caught my attention, where one of the activists said, "This went so far beyond what we could have hoped for, it's better than if we had written it." Well, then I started looking at it, and boy, that's exactly right. You're looking here at a precedent, not only in terms of the actual decision, striking down Iowa's law as unconstitutional, restricting marriage to the union of a man and a woman, but the actual methodology employed in the classroom, this scientism, this establishment of scientific truth defined by this judge arbitrarily as the only important information available to the court in its own findings. As we've already discussed, the court could not even consistently hold to this principle, but this tells us a great deal of where we are today. My guest today is Alan Carlson, who's the president of the Howard Center. He is also the director of the Family in America Study Center and the editor of the Family in America, a widely published author. He was rejected as an expert witness in this case by the judge. He holds a Ph.D. in modern European history from The Ohio University, but this judge said that's just history. All he was interested in was sociological research, scientific research, empirical research, which he would define on his own terms. Dr. Carlson, where does this decision tell you when we consider where we stand in terms of protecting marriage in this generation, in this country right now?
Well, it's a very perilous time right now because this was a sweeping decision. It gave the gay rights side everything they could have wished for and more, just as you indicated. This, for the first time, for example, the so-called right to marry anyone you choose was elevated to the highest level of constitutional scrutiny. That had never happened before.
A fundamental right.
It's a fundamental right. And that had never happened before in any of the other prior decisions by any state or federal court. No, things are very perilous. This decision also references at a key point the Lawrence decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which essentially made sodomy a constitutionally protected behavior. So it's building on some prior decisions, but it opened up a whole new can of worms. And it's quite clear this was a decision largely drafted by the Lambda Legal Defense Association. The language, the concepts they used, the language employed, this judge hardly even bothered to rewrite it. You could probably accuse him of plagiarism here almost. It's a terrible decision.
You know, in the Lawrence decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2003, in his scathing dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia said that that decision was, in effect, a decision to legalize same-sex marriage. It looks like, as we felt at the time, he was, unfortunately, a prophet in that role.
Oh, that's right. This case here, he specifically argues that the adoption of no-fault divorce. Now, this is where part of the deeper problem. The judge here, Hansen, argues that the adoption of no-fault divorce has essentially made marriage into an entirely individualistic concept, that is, with no social purpose or no social control whatsoever, something that an individual can enter into and out of at will. That's part of the deeper problem, is that we've created, in accepting and living with no-fault divorce for so long, we've created some of the legal problems which are now coming back to haunt us.
It reminds me of what Barbara Defoe Whitehead says about divorce when she says, we bought into the idea of expressive divorce. It's just a matter of exercising our autonomy and determining who we are.
No, we are in a very serious position right now, and a lot of work is going to be needed in the next few years to hold the fort and then try to reverse some other things.
We'll be right back to continue this discussion with Dr. Alan Carlson of the Howard Center. We're talking about some of the most urgent issues facing us right now, especially since last Thursday. Just one decision like this can establish a precedent that literally can be heard all across the nation. We'll be right back. All right, folks, this is the way it works. You have an innocuous situation off the screen of most Americans. In Polk County, Iowa, you have a challenge to that state's law enacted just several years ago defining marriage as only the union of a man and a woman. And it was adopted a few years ago because prior to that, no one would have imagined the legal necessity of having such a law. But gay rights activists thought they detected a possible successful challenge to that law, and it was successful beyond their wildest imaginations. Last Thursday, in that Polk County, Iowa courtroom, Judge Robert Hansen handed down a decision, nearly 100 pages long, filled with all kinds of material, including some of the worst legal argumentation I have ever seen. My guest today is Alan Carlson, who is the president of the Howard Center. And he's one of my favorite authors on the subject of the family, both in terms of history and in terms of current social analysis. The Howard Center does great work. He is the editor of The Family in America and several books of which he is also the author. Dr. Carlson, let me ask you, I began by last time asking you where this tells you that we stand. Let me look to the future now and say, how do we counter this kind of argument? How would you encourage Christians to frame a response to this kind of argument?
Well, I think, as in all things political, we first have to get our own lives in order and our own churches in order. We've let a lot of things drift, and I say we, I mean evangelical Protestant Christians as well as Catholic Christians. We need to get our own houses in order first and foremost. We need to have good preaching on marriage, good preaching on the problems of divorce, good preaching on the very purposes of marriage as ordained by God. Genesis 1 and 2, about 80% of what you need to know is right there. We need to go from there and work on our own lives, work on educating our own children. The public, as the gay rights agenda, as the gay rights curriculum has spread in the public education, that's an ever more hostile territory. In a sense, I'd start with getting our own lives together. Then I think the second point is to realize that we've already surrendered a lot of legal terrain, even before same-sex marriage came up. No-fault divorce was a very bad idea, a very bad innovation that caused a lot of damage to a lot of children, a lot of marriages. There wasn't enough of a protest when that was introduced in the late 60s and 70s. To be honest, most of the Christian churches were out to lunch, weren't paying attention.
As they were when Roe v. Wade was handed down in 1973.
Precisely. It was only some years later that evangelical Christians, following Harold O.J. Brown and Francis Schaeffer, began to understand that something terrible had just happened. So we need to understand that it's a long reconstruction project. But again, we start with our own lives, our own churches, our own communities, and meanwhile, do the best we can to defend what's left of marriage legally, which probably at this point, I think about the only a federal marriage amendment seems to be our best shot, although extremely difficult at this point politically.
Yeah, I agree with that analysis entirely. I think a lack of courage on the part of so many politicians means that that's a very dubious prospect right now, the passage of a federal marriage amendment. I have to hope for it and speak for it, but I am not particularly hopeful that we will see it in any near future. And if it doesn't happen in the very near future, I don't think it's going to happen at all. Dr. Carlson, when we're talking about the family here, I appreciate the order, getting our own house in order first, and I especially appreciate your reference to divorce. And our complicity in the divorce culture is coming back to haunt us with this, and I agree with that entirely. However, As much as I might want to say more than, for instance, David Blankenhorn says in his most recent book, I do agree with him on this. As much as we believe that the no-fault divorce laws were a morally abhorrent act that had all kinds of awful effects on the culture, adding same-sex marriage to that simply compounds the injury to the culture. Don't you agree?
Oh, of course. It's sort of, in many ways, it's sort of the final insult to the institution of marriage. By no way would want to say other. I would only say this, though, that if we do succeed in stopping same-sex marriage and turning it around, which is possible, although, again, it's going to be a difficult challenge, if that's all we do, and if we just stop there, we probably shouldn't, it wouldn't be all that important. We've got to repair the institution of marriage at a deeper level as well. But that's the first priority right now, without question.
And rebuilding the institution of marriage, I agree, is such an important issue, not only because we're concerned about sociology and even human happiness, but as a Christian theologian, I have to say it's because the glory of God is in the proper display within his creation of the institution of marriage, which he created for our good. And ultimately, it is a matter of Christian responsibility to seek the glory of God in all things. And today in chapel here at Southern Seminary, I preached on the article of the Creed, Maker of Heaven and Earth. Mm-hmm. And a part of the goodness of creation is the institution of marriage.
Oh, precisely. And even here, even though you're entirely right to criticize the scientism behind this judge's decision, honest, authentic social science screams out one common conclusion, that children do best, have the best prospects for being happy, successful, healthy, well-educated children. And adults, when they grow up with their two biological parents bound together in a marriage, any variation from that, predictably there are going to be more problems. Children are going to face much bigger challenges. So marriage is a pro-child institution. That's why it exists. Ultimately.
And I think most people actually know that. I think in the recesses of their heart and even a knowledge they may try to suppress, they actually do know that. Dr. Carlson, it's been great to have you. Tell us about the work of the Howard Center.
Well, we're a small little think tank out here in the heartland in Rockford, Illinois, but our focus is really on the intersection of family life and religious life, understanding that healthy families grow out of healthy religious communities and vice versa.
Well, I think you're doing just outstanding work. I look forward to every issue I see of The Family in America and your research studies and your own writings. Your books, I think, are really important. So I just want to offer you a word of encouragement. Please keep doing it.
I appreciate that very, very much.
Folks, we're talking about, just as Dr. Carlson said, one of the most important issues, because this is, to quote our guest today, the worst decision yet ever handed down by a court on the issue of same-sex marriage. It sets a precedent that is chilling, and furthermore, it sets a precedent that we should expect, given the way this thing is going, will be repeated in other courts around this country until eventually, and we all know this has to happen, this question arrives at the United States Supreme Court. Real concern about what would happen to it there as well. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Nothing takes place in a vacuum, not in a society like this. And even though most Americans last week were blissfully unconcerned with anything that might be going on in Polk County, Iowa, it turns out that in one sense the world was turned upside down there with the decision of Judge Robert Hansen to redefine marriage. In the various findings in his decision, and they are well over 100 enumerated findings, he says such things as the fact that that homosexuality is a normal expression of human sexuality, and that marriage is basically nothing more than a voluntary association of human beings together for whatever they might want and for however long they might want to stay together. Moral and cultural revolutions come down to something like this. An unexpected place, Polk County, Iowa. An unexpected time. Very few people were really focused on what might happen last Thursday on the question of the institution of marriage. And yet, here it happened. A precedent is set. Alan Carlson, our guest today, made a very important point when he said that this could only become possible, and I'm paraphrasing his argument, because we've already weakened marriage to such an extent. That's the same argument made by David Blankenhorn of the Institute for American Values. Now, they don't end up in the same place, but they do agree with that argument, and that argument is fundamentally right. Dr. Carlson said it would not be enough just to stop gay marriage. We have to recover the institution of marriage. I believe in that wholeheartedly. But I believe in it not just for our social good. I have to come back to the fact that marriage is not just about what's good for raising children. We know that's important. It's ultimately about the glory of God. As Christians, we can never look at the merely statistical. We can't look at the merely operational. We have to look at the deeply theological, and here we are told in God's Word that He established the institution of marriage. Remember in Genesis chapter 2, for our good and for His glory. God is most glorified when His creatures receive and use His gifts as He had intended. The institution of marriage is not up for negotiation. It's not up for redefinition. As Christians, we're the people who need to know why. We need to be able to make the right arguments, but Dr. Carlson's also right. We're not going to have much credibility to make that argument about the absolute identity, nature of the institution of marriage as a heterosexual institution unless we're willing to say, as the Scripture says, one man, one woman, one union for life. We do have a lot of ground to recover, and it's time for intelligent Christians to remind ourselves that this is the responsibility not only of individual Christians, but of local congregations. It's the responsibility of every single Christian congregation, Christian church, to make sure that it understands what marriage is, that it teaches what marriage is from the pulpit, that it reinforces that in the ministries of the church, honors that in terms of the church's life, and holds Christians, and especially Christian couples, accountable the vows they have so solemnly made. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. It's Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.